The first victim falls to her death. The second suffers a fatal overdose. The third takes a bullet to the heart. Three down, more to go. There are people who deserve to die. People who are in the way. And when she's finished, there will be no one left. In Almost Dead, the twisted novel of suspense by New York Times bestselling author Lisa Jackson. Because when you want a book that amps up the thrills, Lisa Jackson kills it every time. Almost Dead is available now everywhere books are sold. And for more info, visit lisajackson.com. And if you're a woman and you're not investing, that could be like losing a fresh new Benjamin every day. That's why there's Elevest, the online investment platform for women. Invest in specific life goals, such as buying a house, starting a business, or retiring your way on your terms. All you have to do is get started. And now, Court Junkie listeners can receive $100 towards your first funded goal when you sign up with Elevest. Visit elevest.com/court. That's elevest.com/court to receive $100 towards your first funded goal. And now, on to today's episode.
When did you meet Barb Kenham?
I met Barb in 1986.
And what was Barb's maiden name?
Barbara Carol Adams.
And by the way, are Barb's parents still alive?
Barb's mother is.
And is she here?
Yes, she is. She's sitting in the front row.
What were the circumstances, or under what circumstances did you meet Barb?
I was at her brother's wedding at the time when I met Barb.
And who is her brother?
David Adams, the guy sitting right next to Barb's mom and his mom.
And why were you at the wedding?
He married my cousin. David married my cousin, Rhonda.
And tell the jury about meeting Barb on that day.
I wasn't a real outgoing, into sports and stuff. It was more of the, you know, doing things in the shop and like that. And we went to the wedding because we have a very tight-knit family. And Barb was at her junior prom, and she came in with a couple of her friends. And when she walked in, I went to my cousin Rhonda and asked her who it was. There was something, just the way she was, I talked to her a little bit. It was a picture book saying, I mean, just one of these things where you know immediately, that's the girl you want. That's the girl I want to talk to. I want to get to know this girl. And that's the feeling that I had the first time I met Barb.
The man you just heard on the stand, talking about how he met his wife Barb, is 47-year-old Todd Kendhammer. Their love story, from the way Todd tells it, seems like something you might read about or see in one of those cheesy romantic movies, where the boy has his sights set on the girl from the moment he sees her. They then become friends while she's dating someone else. Then she breaks up with that guy. And finally, the couple ends up together. They get married, have children, and go on to live happily ever after. Except this story doesn't have a happy ending. And in fact, that love story you just heard may have a serious kink in it. You see, after 25 years of marriage, there would be what Todd says is a tragic accident that would land him on trial for what prosecutors say wasn't an accident at all, but a heinous crime. But either what happened on the morning of September 16th, 2016, really did happen the way Todd says it did, or he was responsible for a pretty involved cover-up for something else, like the murder of his wife. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, Episode 46. The 911 call came in at 8:06 a.m. on September 16, 2016, to the La Crosse County Sheriff's Department in La Crosse, Wisconsin. The man calling was hysterical. He said that he and his wife were driving in their car when a pipe came through their windshield. He said his wife was injured.
Tell me exactly what happened.
They
thank God that she's hit in the head and in the throat, I think, in the throat or something. She's got blood coming out of her nose and mouth and it's already big and blue.
How old is she?
26.
Is she awake?
I'm going to get her to her. She talked to her first a little bit.
Okay, is she breathing?
No, I don't think so.
No. All right, sir. Who do have help on the way? Stand
along. Come on.
You're in. I want you to stay right where you're at, sir.
The dispatcher instructed him to give her chest compressions.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm trying to do something, but I'm going to put the phone down.
Can you get her out of the vehicle, sir?
I got her out.
Okay, I want you to lay her flat on the ground.
I got her flat. I'm not going to stay, but I don't know what to do with her.
Okay, listen carefully. Let me tell you how to do chest compressions. Place the heel of your hand on her breastbone, right between her nipples.
I know how to do that.
The other hand is calm.
I know how to do that.
Pump the chest hard and fast.
He's got blood coming out of his mouth.
That's okay. Go ahead and pump it twice per second and 2 inches deep, okay?
Okay.
Come up all the way between the pumps.
I'll come back in a minute.
Okay, keep going, sir.
She's got blood bubbling out of her mouth.
That's okay. That's okay. We're going to keep pumping the chest hard and fast, okay? You're doing just fine. Keep pumping the chest hard and fast, 2 inches deep. Keep going, sir. You're doing great.
How far are they?
They're coming as fast as they can, sir.
I know, but how fast are they?
They're coming.
I know, but I can't say them much longer like this.
Yes, you can. You're doing a great job. You're doing what you can right now for her.
She's breathing out her ear, too.
Okay.
I can hit her hard when she whipped her up.
Okay. That's okay. We're not hurting her at all right now.
When Brandon Hauser, the first responder to arrive, got to the scene, he saw a black four-door sedan that looked like it had been backed into a ditch on the side of Burgum Cooley Road. The front of the vehicle was hanging out onto the street, while the back was in the ditch. The windshield looked like it had been smashed. The front passenger door was open, and just outside the vehicle, he saw a man, later identified as Todd Kendhammer, kneeling over the woman who was lying on the ground. Brandon knelt down and checked her for a pulse, but couldn't find one. He asked Todd to help him move her up the bank so he could perform CPR. He noticed blood around her nose and mouth, and bruising on both sides of her neck. He cut her shirt and bra off and started CPR. Todd, meanwhile, was in hysterics, yelling at him to save his wife. West Salem officer Lance Leffoltz was the first officer to arrive. Brandon quickly asked him to remove Todd from the scene so that he could keep working on the woman. Officer Leffoltz pulled Todd to the side and asked him what had happened.
Come on, bud.
Copy, caught in progress.
I did it harder. Was that bad?
No,
it's bad. I know CPR first aid. Come on, Bart.
Let's take him.
Take him. Sir, come on over with me, okay?
Go out the officer, sir.
Come with me. Who is this?
My wife.
It's your wife? Okay. What happened? Do you know what happened?
There's a pipe.
Come up here by the thing. Okay.
It's gonna be all right.
I don't know, okay? Let first responders and... Stay right here, okay? There was a pipe in the ground.
No, come out of that tree, off a truck.
Off a truck?
A truck or a trailer or something. I think it was a truck with a flatbed on it.
And the truck kept going?
It didn't. I don't know if he fell through it.
I didn't see one. Okay. Were you in the car with her?
I was driving.
Okay. All right, stay right here. Okay. I don't know. Let first responders and everybody deal with them, okay?
Stay. I tried to catch it.
Catch the pipe?
I tried to see it. I hit it. I went to hit it, but the windshield got me.
It came across the windshield?
It came through the windshield.
Okay, just stay right here.
Todd kept looking over as the responders worked on his wife. Oh my God, she's spitting blood out of her mouth, he exclaimed as another ambulance pulled up. Officer Leffels asked Todd where the pipe was now, and Todd said he had pulled it out of the windshield, and so it was now lying next to the car. He told him that he had gotten his wife out of the car and had started doing CPR on her when the first responders arrived. Officer Leffels asked where the couple had been heading when they were hit by the pipe, and Todd said that he had to go pick up a windshield to install a windshield onto a car and then was going to take his wife to work. He is still hysterical as he tries to speak, and so Officer Leffels instructs him to take deep breaths.
Hang tight. Why don't you just lean against here, okay? Just lean. You start. Okay, Todd, listen to me. Through the nose, deep breaths. You're starting to hyperventilate, okay? Through the nose. Out the mouth, slow. Slow down. Through the nose, out the mouth. Through the nose, out the mouth. Let them work with her, okay? Through the nose, out the mouth. Slow down.
Another officer arrives on the scene and stands with Todd while Leffels goes to the vehicle to look at the pipe. He sees a hole in the windshield, and sure enough, a pipe was lying next to the car. He walks back over to Todd and asks more questions.
You know what type, if any, I know it's, you got 101 things going through your mind, but was it a truck with a trailer?
It looked like a flatbed.
A flatbed?
Like an older flatbed.
Truck?
Yeah, it was an older truck.
Okay, and it was heading northbound too?
It
was heading west, southbound, okay.
The first responders load the woman up onto a stretcher and place her in the back of the ambulance. Todd asks if he could go to the hospital with his wife, and the first responders tell him no.
Just stay right here. Let me talk to them.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Well, we'll get you down there, okay? We'll get you down to Gunderson. But there's just going to be so much going on inside there. There isn't going to be room for you in there, okay?
Let's say goodbye. I'm through with her, please.
If they won't allow you in there, I can't force them to let you be in there, but we'll get you down there, okay? Todd, I can't.
Is she okay?
I can't tell you that. I don't know.
Can I
go over there? Why don't you stay right here? We'll just stay right here. I know this is hard, but I can't let you in there right now, okay? They're working on her.
Leffels walks over to the first responders and the other officers who are there. She's not making it, is she? He asks. And then one of the officers asks him an interesting question.
He wants to know if he can at least come over and say goodbye. She's not making it, is she? Because the pipe is there. He said the pipe, the truck was going this way. It was an older flatbed. It came off the flatbed truck and went right through the windshield. He said he tried to deflect it, but he couldn't, and it hit her in the head, and she just started flailing all over.
Does this look normal to you?
Well, he said he backed up because he was such a panic. But there's a hole. Is this normal? No. But I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I...
46-year-old Barbara Kendhammer was taken to Gunderson Health System, where she died the next day from her injuries. Todd and Barbara Kendhammer had been married for 25 years, having just celebrated their 25th wedding anniversary about a month prior to her death. They had met while they were just teenagers in high school and had gotten married when Todd was 22 and Barb was 21. They both grew up and lived in La Crosse, Wisconsin, where they soon started their own family. They had two children and one grandchild. Barb worked in the food service program at West Salem Middle School, where she had been employed for the last 14 years, while Todd worked at a company called Crown Cork and Seal, a packaging company. The circumstances surrounding Barb's death seemed a little suspicious to investigators. Todd had told them that he had been driving north on Highway M at about 8 a.m. when he saw a pipe fall from an oncoming flatbed truck that had been traveling in the opposite direction. The pipe then went through their windshield, striking his wife. He said he then turned onto Burgum Cooley Road. He removed the pipe from the windshield and dragged Barbara out of the passenger seat, trying to perform CPR on her for 5 minutes before calling 911. He told investigators that he and Barb had left their home at about 7:45 that morning. They were on their way to Holman, a town about 20 minutes away and in the opposite direction from Barb's work, when the incident occurred. He said he was going to one of his coworkers' houses so he could pick up a truck that needed a new windshield. But the problem was, investigators had interviewed that coworker, a man named Justin Heim, and Justin had told them that he hadn't been expecting Todd that morning, that there was no truck that needed a windshield, and that Todd didn't even know where he lived. And not only that, but when investigators met with the medical examiner who performed Barb's autopsy, she told them that she didn't believe a pipe could have caused all of Barbara's injuries. So about a week after Barb's death, on September 22, 2016, investigators called Todd into the police station to try to make sense of some of the discrepancies. Investigator Fritz Leinfelder and Sergeant Mark Yealy took Todd into an interrogation room to start their questioning. They told Todd that they needed to know the exact timeline of what happened that morning so they could look through surveillance video to try to find the flatbed truck. Todd reiterated that they had left that morning at about 7:45 on their way to Holman. He said at first, it looked like a bird was coming at them, and so he tried to reach out for it, hitting the glass. He said he held on to the steering wheel with his right hand, but he ended up using both hands to try and lunge over, but the pipe smashed into the windshield. He described Barb as thrashing and flailing, trying to get away from it. He said he didn't know how or why, but he put the car in reverse and then got out. He yanked her out of the car and said he didn't think he did it nicely. He said he remembers that her head fell down as he was pulling her out. He told the officers that she was bleeding out of her nose, mouth, and ears, and so he took his shirt and tried to clean her off a little bit. He said he thought he may have taken her around the neck with one hand to get her out of the car. He was in panic mode, he said. Todd told them that he wasn't sure about the details, when exactly he removed the pipe from the windshield, but he did. He said he pulled it from the outside and then threw it. When asked about the truck, Todd said all he remembered is that the back had a flatbed with signs on it. There must have been something in the back of it because it looked like the pipe was on top, he told them. He said he had ordered a windshield for his coworker, Justin Heim, a month earlier, and that Barb was on him to get it out of their garage where he had been storing it. He said fixing windshields was a side business that he and Barb had going for years. The usual process would be that they would go pick up the car that's windshield needed fixing and then drive it home. There, he and Barb would then set the new windshield onto the car and then take it back later in the night. As for the cuts on his hands, he said it must be from lunging at the pipe, but that he's just guessing. And the scratches on his neck, he said, was from work when he had cut himself with glass. He kept reiterating to the investigators that when he got Barb out of the car, he, quote, knows he didn't get her out nice and soft. The investigators asked why he kept saying that.
I didn't just press her and tip her out nice and soft. I didn't do that.
What makes you...
I've never, ever, in 28 years, never touched her or grabbed her or raised my voice with her, and I was mad at myself. For some reason, it had to be because I got out of the car.
Todd told them that the plan that morning was to take Barb to work if the truck wasn't there. He said Justin had told him a month ago where the truck was. After letting Todd talk for a bit, the investigators began pressing him for details and asking about inconsistencies they said they had found. For one, Justin had told them that he and Todd had talked about possibly repairing a windshield for one of his friends months prior, but that his friend had changed his mind, and so Todd had told him that he sold the windshield not long after that. But Todd said no, that the windshield had been sitting in his garage. He then asks why they're questioning him.
Are you guys insinuating that I did this to my wife?
I'm not insinuating anything at this point. I'm saying that Justin was saying that there wasn't a witch of order. He didn't talk to you. He hadn't seen you in about a month.
And so I told you, at least a month, maybe, I'm just guessing, Mark, but I'm not changing my story. I'm 100%.
I'm not saying you are.
I'm 100%.
I'm just telling you that any time that somebody dies, whether it be a traffic accident, there's obviously a lot of questions, and if we just take the first person, one person's word for it when they're under stress, that's why we're here today, is just to kind of clear things up, and try to get answers to some of those other questions. Obviously, as time goes by, more questions come up, and we wouldn't be doing our jobs if we don't look into it thoroughly.
So. Yeah. And that's why, Ken, when you called, I want to get this for Barb.
Sure.
The investigators then moved on to Barb's injuries. As for the bruising on her chest, Todd said that in between chest compressions, he poked Barb to see if she would respond. He said he was trying not to move her head as much as possible. The officers showed him photos of injuries he had at the hospital, including scratches on his neck and chest and cuts on his hands.
What about these?
I don't know. I honestly can't tell you. I know they're not from me.
Okay.
You
know they're not from you.
I mean, I didn't do it with my hand or like that or, I don't know.
Now that you're not sure about that, what happened?
I think I had that before the accident.
Okay.
I think. Because I don't know.
And how did that happen?
I don't know. I honestly don't. I mean,
when did you first realize, when did you first notice you had that?
When you guys asked for it.
When you took a picture in the hospital?
I didn't. I mean, I get scratches and cuts and
so you didn't notice that you had a scratch there?
No, I didn't know it.
But no, you're pretty sure it happened before the accident.
I don't know. I can't say.
Todd told the investigators that the house was in Barb's name and that he didn't know if there was any insurance on her. You can ask anybody, he said. I would do anything for her. Anything. He said their kids just threw them a surprise 25th anniversary party and that he, quote, very much loved her a lot. But again, the detectives brought up Barb's injuries and how the pipe didn't seem to match them. Todd again reiterated that Barb hit her head when he pulled her out of the car, but the officer said that didn't account for them. Todd said that it was possible that the plastic mug she was holding had been the cause of some of her injuries, but the officers told him that didn't account for the injuries either. The officers told him some of her injuries included a broken nose, her lip pressed hard against her teeth, crushed cartilage in her throat, 3 extremely deep lacerations down the back of her head, a skull fracture, a huge bruise on her jaw, and a cut across her forehead on the right side. That wouldn't be from one pipe coming through the windshield, they told him. Help us explain the injuries, Sergeant Ely said. I can't, Todd replied.
I don't understand those injuries. I don't.
Neither do we, and that's why we need your help. Because the mechanism, your injuries, we're not talking about. We're talking about the injuries on Barbara.
Right.
And the mechanism in which was described by you isn't consistent with those injuries happening. It's improbable for those injuries to happen because there's too many different planes. There's something that happened before the accident.
And
something went wrong. Something went haywire.
No, I did not. I've never gone haywire. I've never gone.
From what we see here is, you know, the scratches on your neck kind of indicate that maybe somebody's trying to defend themselves, and which tells us that this wasn't something that anybody planned out. Maybe an argument that any married couple could get into got out of hand.
She didn't die, really.
She didn't die until she got to the hospital.
We didn't. No. Absolutely not.
They then brought up the fact that Todd's employer had told them that he was a very good employee, someone who had only used 5 of his sick days the prior year. Yet on the morning of the incident, he never would have made it to work on time if his story about picking up the truck was true. And the detective pointed out that he hadn't called into work to say that he was going to be late, and he hadn't called in sick either. But Todd said that he does this at least 5 times a year for stuff like this, and that he had been planning on calling in sick before the incident occurred. When asked about their financial situation, Todd said they were doing excellent. Their house was almost paid off. They only owed $9,000 on their car and had no other debts. He said he makes about $90,000 a year and Barb made about $15,000. They flipped houses on the side and would take loans out from the bank for that. He said they never had problems paying their bills on time. But the investigators ultimately told Todd that they didn't believe him.
I'm telling you, I have nothing else.
You have it up there. It's up there.
I don't.
This happened to married couples all the time. They would appear amongst their friends, be a perfectly married couple, and bad things happen all the time. They don't, and I could bet that 99% of those guys would have never believed that it could have come to that, that it never could have happened that way, that they weren't even capable of it, and they just got into a rage and couldn't stop what was happening.
Well, why would I have a prank?
We just had a little conversation. What are the odds, first of all, to come down a road that isn't heavily traveled and have a pipe come through your windshield?
But that road heavily traveled in the mornings and evenings.
Well, not like an interstate or a U.S. highway. So there aren't regular vehicles, and of all those vehicles, very few of them are going to be carrying a pipe. Even fewer of them are going to have the pipe come loose. Even less odds that it's going to land where it did, in the manner it did, and then sustain the injuries that she had. And in addition to that, what are the odds that that would happen to a guy that changes windshields? I mean, what do you suppose is out there? One in a trillion, at all?
But there's that
so,
one.
But you asked me
the
about
totality, the
you
totality.
Asked me about the pipe. You know, that's that explains how the pipe might get there.
What do you mean?
The guy that knows windshields and.
Oh gosh, you guys. I mean, no. There's absolutely no way. There's absolutely no way that if I was going to hurt my wife, I would have done it like this. Absolutely no way.
I'm not saying you shoved the bike through and hit her. I'm saying somewhere along the road you got in an argument.
You got an argument.
We did not get in an argument.
And it came to blows. It got out of control. And
we did not.
You thought she was dead.
We did not get in an argument. Absolutely no way.
The detectives told Todd that they were going to serve search warrants for their phones, and Todd told them they could and said, "I wish you the best. Someday you're going to tell us what happened," Sergeant Ely said as the interview came to an end. And then, 2.5 months after Barb's death, Todd was arrested and charged with first-degree intentional homicide. Support for today's show comes from Zola. Zola is reinventing the wedding planning and registry experience to make the happiest moment in couples' lives even happier. With over 500 top brands and 50,000 gifts, experiences, and cash funds, Zola Registry has everything you love about your favorite department store, plus things like honeymoon funds, fitness classes, wine subscriptions, and more. You can personalize your registry with photos and notes about why you're coveting certain gifts. And Zola even offers price matching and free shipping every day. Better yet, Zola's friendly customer service team will go above and beyond, helping your loved one pick out the perfect blender, walking your grandmother through the registry, and more. And Zola's full suite of tools can be managed from the Zola Weddings app for iPhone and Android. Join over 300,000 couples who have used Zola. To sign up with Zola and receive a $50 credit towards your registry, go to zola.com/junkie. That's Zola, Zola.com/junkie for $50 towards your registry. This episode is also sponsored by Lisa. Driven by the mission to provide a better place to sleep for everybody, Lisa is an innovative direct-to-consumer online mattress brand that is also socially conscious. In fact, for every 10 mattresses Lisa sells, they donate one to a shelter through their 110 program. They also plant one tree for every mattress sold and donate 1% of each employee's time to volunteer for local causes. Not to mention, with a patented universal adaptive feel, Lisa is designed for all types of sleepers and features three premium foam layers, including a 2-inch Avena foam top layer for cooling and breathability, a 2-inch memory foam middle layer for body contouring and pressure relief, and 6-inch dense core support foam for durability and structure, which works for sleepers of all sizes. And now, Lisa is continuing to expand its offerings to include the Lisa pillow, blanket, foundation, and frame. No wonder it's a Forbes top 20 startup to watch. Try a Lisa mattress in your own home for 100 nights risk-free. Available in the US, UK, Canada, and Germany online. With free shipping, this 100% American-made mattress ships compressed in a box right to your door. Or you can try it at the Lisa Dream Gallery in Soho, New York City and Virginia Beach, and over 80 West Elm stores nationwide. Get $100 off when you go to leesa.com/junkie. Opening statements began on December 5th, 2017, with La Crosse County Circuit Judge Todd Bjerk presiding. In his opening statements, La Crosse County DA Tim Grunke acknowledged that he had a difficult job ahead of him. You won't hear any evidence that Todd and Barbara were fighting. They were married for 25 years, had two children, a grandchild. Many people said they were a good couple, a happy couple, a normal couple, he said. But he told the jury that Todd's story doesn't match the evidence, and that GPS records from their phones show that Todd and Barbara were at a neighbor's house from 7:30 to 7:50 a.m. before driving on Highway M, where the incident was alleged to have occurred. He also told the jury that there was no surveillance video ever found of the flatbed truck, and that Barb's autopsy is inconsistent with what Todd said happened. In his opening statement, defense attorney Stephen Hurley told the jury that Todd's love for his wife was the reason he couldn't be guilty. He played Todd's 911 calls in court, pointing out how distressed he was in those calls. He countered what the DA said, that Todd's story didn't make sense. He said Todd was only questioned when he was in a, quote, terrible emotional state, and that that caused him to be inaccurate, including about the description of the truck. He said Barb's injuries are consistent with that of a pipe going through the windshield and that, quote, when you've heard everything, you will know Todd Kendhammer could have never even had the thought pass through his head, and I will ask you to find him not guilty. West Salem police officer Lance Leffeltz was called to the stand first. He was the first officer who responded to the scene. He said it was outside his jurisdiction, so he was just there to assist. His dash cam video was played for the court, where he speaks with Todd minutes after the incident occurred. Photos of Todd at the scene were then displayed for the jury. The front of his shirt appeared to have bloodstains on it, and there were what looked like cuts and blood on the backs of his hands. La Crosse County Sheriff's Officer Adam Wickland was the fourth officer at the scene. He said he too spoke with Todd about what happened. He said Todd appeared nervous and upset about what was going on. Todd told him the pipe had struck his windshield and said that they had been on their way to Holman to pick up a vehicle. Wickland placed Todd in his squad car and described him as cooperative. Audio from their conversation in the squad car was played for the jury. In the audio, Todd again says how he wants to ride with Barb to the hospital and says that she won't know anyone when she gets there. I'm always with her, though, he says. He starts crying, and it sounds as though he starts panicking while in the car, when he notes a news van pulling up.
What's the Channel News 8 doing?
Pardon me?
What's News 8 doing?
Uh,
probably heard the call of the scanner because they have a scanner, like police scanner like we have.
So nothing's bad.
What's that?
Nothing's bad, right?
I only know what you know.
You must know something. You got a radio.
You've been hearing the radio the whole time. Oh, I have. God. I haven't heard anything. One way or another.
We need to get down to here.
Photos from the scene were then shown to the jury, and Wicklund described what the jury was looking at. The car was parked alongside of the road, the back of the car in a ditch, while the front of the car was poking out onto the street. The passenger door was open, and a right foot tennis shoe could be seen on the floorboard. On the center of the seat was broken glass and dirt. There was blood on the center console and blood on the floor mat. Barbara's purse was in the back seat on the passenger side, her cell phone and wallet still inside. Todd's cell phone was found outside on the ground, towards the rear of the vehicle on the passenger side. The pipe was also found on the ground by the rear of the vehicle on the passenger side. A left foot tennis shoe was lying outside in the tall grass, which Wicklund said had been found after the car had been towed. There was also blood on the right rear passenger side tire and on the rim. Inside the trunk was grass and dirt. There was a hole in the passenger side of the windshield, and the windshield itself was bulged out, almost from the inside out, Wicklund said. Forensic pathologist Kathleen McCubbin performed the autopsy on Barbara. She said she also reviewed a report on the specifics of the accident, as well as Barbara's medical records, photos of the car at the scene, and photos of the pipe. She told the jury that the cause of Barbara's death was blunt impact injuries of her head and neck. She documented numerous injuries on Barbara's body, including bruises on her torso, arms, and legs. Photos of these injuries were shown to the jury. And then McCubbin pointed out three lacerations on the back of Barbara's head.
This is a picture of the back of Mrs. Ken Hammer's head, and these are the three lacerations that I described earlier. So the top of her head is in this direction, and her neck is down here. So this is the left back side of the head, and there was a 3/4-inch laceration there. And then on the right side, it's a little difficult to see here, but there's two lacerations right next to each other.
What would cause these type of lacerations?
And these are blunt impact injuries, so they could be caused by something striking the head. Alternatively, they could be caused by the head being falling or striking or pushing into something as well that's blunt and firm.
About how many impacts do you think would have caused these three lacerations?
I think it's likely that there were at least two, if not three, impacts here, because this site is somewhat separate from these two clustered. I can't say definitively if this represented one injury against an uneven object, but I do feel there are at least likely two injuries or two impacts here.
She was then asked whether the injuries were consistent with Todd's story.
When you looked at these injuries, do you think they came from a pipe?
I do not believe that these injuries are consistent with the end of a pipe striking the back of the head, no.
And why do you have that opinion?
Because I don't see any evidence of a curvilinear mark from the end of a pipe. I also think that if a pipe was traveling with great force and struck the back of the head, if you're going to say that these were all from the pipe, then it would have to be traveling sort of tangentially across the back of the head. And I believe that in that situation, it would actually avulse the tissue because the intense energy of the pipe traveling at that speed into the back of the head would cause worse damage than just these few lacerations.
On cross-examination, the defense attorney asked if McCubbin had a background in accident reconstruction, and she said no. She was asked if movements of Barbara's body after the accident could have caused the scrapes or contusions, and she said yes. When asked if it was possible that the pipe struck Barbara in more than one place, she said, "That's possible, yes." On redirect, McCubbin said that Barbara's injuries could be consistent with a beating or strangulation, and that she would have expected more devastating injuries if a pipe would have hit her. "Certain injuries raise a high level of suspicion for me," she said. The prosecution called Justin Heim to the stand. And as you'll recall, he's the guy Todd said he was going to see the morning of his wife's death. Todd had told police that Justin, who was a coworker of his, had a friend whose windshield needed to be fixed. Justin testified that earlier in the year, he spoke with Todd about his friend Ben needing his windshield fixed, but when he talked to Ben to confirm, Ben told him that he didn't want to have it done because it was just a farm truck and not a top priority for him. Justin said that he told Todd that his friend didn't want to have his windshield replaced after all, and Todd said okay. This was months prior to Barbara's death. He also recalled that in the summer, Todd told him that he no longer had a windshield for his friend anyway. He said he was not aware of any reason why Todd would have been coming to his house the morning of September 16th. He said Todd had never even been to his house before, and they hadn't spoken in weeks, possibly even months. Justin also said that Todd would not work with glass during his job, even though Todd had told police that he had cuts on his hands due to dealing with glass at his workplace. A man named Randall Erler testified that on September 16th, he was on his way to work when he saw a vehicle that looked like it was doing a wide turn. Its back end was in a ditch, and the front end was sticking out on the road. As he passed the car, he looked to see if he could help in any way, but didn't see anyone. He said the passenger door was open, and he saw no damage whatsoever to the windshield, or else he would have stopped. He also said he didn't remember seeing the headlights on. He said he arrived at his work a couple minutes after 8 a.m. The next day, he was contacted by police about what he saw. He didn't know anything about the investigation at that point. The next witness was one of Barbara's coworkers from West Salem Middle School, who testified that they would occasionally hurt themselves at work, but that it was rare. When they did, they would get burns on their arms or hands. She worked with Barb on the day before her death and didn't notice any bruises on her. Barbara's supervisor, Cheryl Elliott, told the jury that on September 16th, Barbara was scheduled to be at work from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m., which was her normal, everyday schedule. She said if Barb were ever late, she would call and let her know. Barb was known as a punctual employee. On September 16th, Barb did not call and didn't show up at her normal time at 8 a.m., which was unusual. She called Barbara several times, starting at 8:02. She said she had to call other employees to fill in for her. She also didn't recall seeing any bruises on Barb the day prior. Sandra Carlson works at the La Crosse County Medical Examiner's Office and was present at the autopsy. She said she was familiar with the Kendhammers because their daughter was good friends with her daughter. She said her daughter was putting a poster board together for Barbara's funeral at the Kendhammer house when she called and asked her to drop off some supplies. So Sandra went over there, and while she was there, she saw Todd.
So I ran this stuff out to her and went downstairs to the basement where they were putting poster boards together. Gave my condolences, excused myself, walked back upstairs, and Todd was in the kitchen. And I gave him a hug and told him I was sorry for his loss. And
we'll stop right there. Were you there in your role as an investigator or just an acquaintance?
No, I was just an acquaintance.
At this point, did he talk to any law enforcement officers?
No.
Did you ask Mr. Kendhammer some questions about the incident?
I did.
And do you remember specifically what question you asked?
Yes.
What was the first question?
I had asked him about a rash below Barbara's neck here. And that we had questioned during autopsy how they had gotten there.
What did he say?
He said he believed it was from him. He was poking her to try to get her to wake up.
Okay. Did he say why he poked her instead of shook her?
He said he poked her because he didn't want to jar her neck. In case her, you know, she had injured her neck.
Did you ask him anything else?
I did. I had asked him about a couple of lacerations that we had found on the base of her skull. He claimed that he wasn't quite sure of it, but it could have been from when he drug her out of the car to get her out of the vehicle.
Did he show you any injuries to himself?
He did. He showed me lacerations on his hands, knuckles.
Was it both hands?
It was both hands, yeah.
Did you actually see any injuries to both hands?
I did, yes.
Was he emotional?
Very, very.
Did he indicate he was having a hard time dealing with Barbara's death?
Yes. Wasn't sleeping well at night and just visibly shaken.
Were those the only questions you asked him?
Yes, yes.
Deputy Rich Amundson is a deputy sheriff with the La Crosse County Sheriff's Office. On September 16th, he went to the hospital in the hopes of talking to Barbara about how she got injured. But with the emergency care she was receiving, he wasn't able to talk to her. When Todd arrived with Sergeant Yealy, he spoke with him. He took photos of Todd's injuries, the cuts on his hands, scratches and abrasions on his face and neck, and scratch marks and abrasions on the right side of his chest. He also talked to him about his injuries.
Did you say you spoke to Mr. Kendhammer?
Yes.
And can you tell me about that conversation?
The conversation I had with Mr. Kendhammer, looking at his overall appearance and the scratches on his face, neck, chest, the abrasions to his hands, I asked him how he got those markings.
And what did he say?
He said that he works with glass a lot and he gets scratched up.
What was his demeanor when you were speaking to him?
I would classify it as solemn. I mean, he was not animated in any way, just more very reserved and subdued.
Deputy Amundson also checked the surveillance video from nearby businesses for any sign of the truck Todd said had dropped the pipe. He did not see any vehicles that matched the suspect vehicle. The prosecution called Captain Zimmerman to the stand. He told the jury that a press release was sent out to the media after the incident, asking people to contact them if they were driving on Bergen Coulee Road that morning and saw anything suspicious. When they searched Todd's property, he said there was a windshield that had been found in the garage. He testified that cell phone records show that Barb always called her mom every morning around 7:45. On the morning of the incident, however, she did not. In fact, she didn't make any calls or send any text messages that morning. Michael Marquardt with the Wisconsin State Patrol is part of their technical reconstruction unit. He reconstructed the alleged crash and explained how the pipe would have traveled had it fallen off a truck, as Todd had alleged.
In this particular case, then, did you determine how high the hole in the windshield we've been talking about was from the ground?
Yes.
What was that height?
4.02 feet.
And were you also familiar with the statement given by the defendant to law enforcement?
Yes.
And were you aware of what he described as a pipe coming off a truck, that scenario?
Yes.
And what kind of a truck did he say was used to have this pipe fall off?
My understanding was what I'd call a flatbed pickup truck.
And did you attempt to calculate how high that pipe might have fallen from?
We did, yes, or I did.
How did you determine that?
We looked at that statement. We made an estimate of what a typical flatbed style pickup truck's bed would be height-wise. The defendant also talked about the fact that that truck had some type of a side rail on it. He had estimated, or they had estimated, somewhere within those reports that it was between 18 and 24 inches. So with a 4 foot high truck bed with a 24 inch side rail, that works out to be 6 feet. So our starting height for the pipe at that point would have been 6 feet high.
And easy math then, a height of 6 feet falling to about 4 feet is about 2 feet of a fall?
That's correct.
Did you calculate how much time it would take for a pipe to drop those 2 feet?
Yes, that horizontal distance that it falls in Earth's gravitational field at 32.2 feet per second works out to be 0.352 seconds, or approximately one-third of a second.
Now, there's obviously some variables that could change. To have more than a third of a second, or 0.352 seconds, to see or observe this falling object, what variable would have to change?
If you principally change the height that it would start from, that would be the D, or the distance element, in the mathematical formula.
Any other variables?
You could change a time component, perhaps, or something to that effect, but not in this particular instance, no.
And you talked about the rate of falling objects due to the laws of gravity. Does that apply to every object?
As long as there isn't wind resistance or some type of aerodynamic forces, if it's not a glider that's flying with wings, or it doesn't have a large surface area where as it's falling, the wind would be essentially slowing it down. If you think of a parachutist, the difference when free fall, when they have their hands straight out from them versus when they're kind of in a pike position and they're just screaming coming down, that would be terminal velocity or free fall. So if the pipe had some type of aerodynamic properties that it would fly, then it would affect things.
DNA analyst Kevin Scott from the Wisconsin State Crime Lab testified that DNA from under Barbara's fingernails belonged to both Barb and Todd. Swabs from the interior side of the defect in the windshield belonged to Todd. And when he swabbed DNA from the pipe, Todd's DNA was the major contributor and the minor contributor was Barb. Scott told the jury that an initial test he conducted on the pipe showed a possible presence for blood, but that rust could also trigger a false positive test. Nick Stulke, a crime laboratory forensic scientist, examined the interior and exterior of Todd's car. He told the jury that the length of the pipe was 53 inches long, the diameter was 1.5 inches wide, and it weighed 10 pounds, 5 ounces. He showed the jury photos of the car, including the windshield. He pointed at areas of the windshield that were, quote, of concern. He said they were protruding outward. When looking at the glass fracture pattern, he noted that there were at least 2 impacts to the windshield. He told the jury that the first 2 impacts to the windshield were from the inside of the vehicle. There was no blood found on Barb's headrest, on the passenger side of the windshield, or on the passenger door. There was blood on the center console, on Barb's seatbelt, on the front of her seat, and on the passenger side floor mat. He said he did not see blood on the pipe recovered at the scene, and a test done on one end of the pipe was negative for blood. There was dirt and glass found on the passenger seat and in the door seal, which he said led him to a conclusion that didn't jive with Todd's story.
In your report, did you form any opinions as to where people might have been seated when that glass and dirt was deposited?
Well, just the fact that the dirt and the glass were present on the cushion of this seat would indicate that no one was seated in this seat or in this front seat area when those substances were deposited on that seat.
And any opinion as to whether or not the door was open or not when those materials were deposited?
I do. I believe that because of the lack of glass in the map pocket and dirt on the interior side of the front door, I believe that door was open during the deposition of the glass and the dirt on this particular front seat area.
He noted that there were bloodstains on the wheel of the right rear passenger side. And with that, the prosecution rested. The defense's first witness was a man named Mark Meshulam, who said he's a full-time consultant and expert witness specializing in glass, windows, and building exteriors. Meshulam testified that the glass fracture pattern indicates that there were 3 different events that caused the glass to break. The first one, he said, occurred when Todd's fist went into the glass to try to stop the pipe. The second was the pipe puncture itself, and the third was the prying that took place when Todd removed the pipe from the hole and brought it around to the side of the car. As for Todd's injuries to his hands, Meshulam said that the glass microparticles from the shattered windshield could have caused them. Dr. Barry Bates, a biomechanics expert, testified that Barbara's injuries were indeed caused by the pipe going through the windshield. But on cross-examination, he agreed with the prosecutor that there could be other explanations for her injuries.
You indicated in your report that the injury to her face, specifically the bilateral nasal fracture, could have come from the defendant smashing her face into the dash.
I said that was a possibility.
That's one possibility. Now, you also indicated in your report that some of the injuries to the neck, strangulation was a possibility. Is that accurate?
That's what other people said. I didn't think it was a real good possibility, but I didn't think I said. I think I identified strangulation as something that had been documented. A possible strangulation had been documented in the records.
Okay. Page 11 of the report, do you still have it up there? Exhibit 260.
Okay, where are you on page 11?
The last full paragraph.
Dr. Gubin described?
Yes.
Okay.
About three quarters of the way down in the middle, there's a sentence that says attempted strangulation is a possibility.
Yes.
It says then to apply anterior posterior forces to her neck as implied, B. Kenhammer would have had to be facing T. Kenhammer, which would be reasonable if, in fact, they were fighting slash struggling at this time.
Yes.
Is that accurate?
Yes.
You said reaching across the center console to accomplish this would have been difficult but possible. Did I read that accurate?
Yes.
Okay. So you did write that attempted strangulation is a possibility, difficult but possible.
Difficult but possible.
Okay. And this next question was about the blood found on the rear passenger tire.
Did you evaluate the crime scene and see the blood on the rear passenger tire?
I did not look at the bloods at the scene, but there was a photograph, either a photograph or mention of a few drops of blood on the rear tire.
Okay.
On the rear of the car.
Could I have the screen up again? Can you go to picture 32?
I've seen that photo, yes.
You've seen this photograph. Okay, it's exhibit number 32 for the record. You see some blood on the grass.
Yes.
It appears to be some transfer activity on the tire. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Okay. This is exhibit 33. Do you also see some blood on the grass in that area?
Yes.
Exhibit 34 is, again, at the scene, some blood spatter on the rim of the tire.
Correct.
The injuries that we see, lacerations at the back of the head, would be consistent with somebody bashing a head against the rim of a tire, would it not?
Could be, yes.
Okay.
And then more questions about Barbara's injuries and Todd's.
This is exhibit 70. You observe the scratches on her neck.
Yes.
Do you agree that those would be consistent with the attempted strangulation with a person scratching their neck to get hands off their neck?
Possibility, yes.
And 81, please. I'm showing exhibit 81. These are scratches to Mr. Kenhammer's neck, to his left side. Did you see those?
Yes.
Would that be consistent with a struggle, two people facing each other in a car and fighting?
Could be.
Okay. You didn't mention, I don't think, a cricoid fracture. Do you remember reading about the cricoid fracture in the autopsy?
I remember reading about a lot of fractures in the neck throat region, and I basically did not deal with them.
Don't you think it's important to deal with them?
My position was that those were more medically oriented, and I am not a medical doctor, and therefore I felt it was the doctor's responsibility to deal with those. The one I felt I was qualified to deal with was the cervical.
Okay.
And that, not because it's of the medical, but because of the biomechanical.
That's all I have then.
The defense then called Dr. Stephen Cook, who practices in Wisconsin, to the stand. Dr. Cook testified that Barbara's injuries are, quote, entirely consistent with Todd's version of events and not consistent with that of a beating. But on cross-examination, he, too, admitted that they could have been consistent with a fight.
The defendant had injuries to both hands, injuries to both sides of his neck, his chest. The victim had injuries about her head. You're saying that's inconsistent with a fight.
In this situation, I don't believe it was a fight.
Do you think these injuries are inconsistent with a fight? We've got fingernail scratches, abrasions, bruises.
You can sustain those type of injuries in a fight, if that's what you're asking.
You indicated that in a beating you'd expect to see defensive injuries, is that right?
That is correct.
Did you see the bruises to the back of Ms. Kenhammer's left hand?
On the left hand, there was, I do recall that she had a bruise, yes.
Consistent with covering up oneself and getting struck in the hand?
I did not feel that was a classic defensive type injury.
You understood that she had broken nails, at least one broken nail?
I remember one broken nail.
And you understand that Mr. Kenhammer's DNA was found underneath her nails?
Okay.
You think that's inconsistent with the struggle?
I don't know what that's consistent with. Okay. I don't think that's inconsistent with the struggle, but I don't know that that represents a struggle.
And then Todd Kenhammer took the stand. Todd described his job history, which included working at four different places and starting a small glass shop and then selling his shares of it, before finally ending up at the place he worked when the incident occurred, Crown Cork and Seal. He also replaced auto glass on the side. Todd said that when he met Barb at her brother's wedding, he knew right away he wanted to get to know her. They started hanging out and were friends for 3 years while she dated someone else. About a year later, they officially started dating. They got married on August 3rd, 1991. Todd told the jury that he and Barb did everything together, including things like mow the lawn and shovel the driveway. She even helped him replace auto glass for his side jobs. He said he and Barb are both right-handed. He then told the jury that on the Friday Barb was killed, they had been planning on going camping for the weekend. When asked about their finances, Todd said they were a year ahead paying the house and car and were having no difficulties. They also flipped houses, about six of them, and had no problems getting loans through the bank. In 2016, Todd said he had a conversation with people at his work in the lunchroom about a windshield. He said he ordered a windshield for one of Justin's friends, but that something happened with the truck and Justin's friend could no longer afford it, so it was sitting in his garage. He said Barb didn't like it being in their garage, and a couple days prior to the incident, she again asked him to get rid of it. He said the name of the guy whose windshield he was going to replace wasn't Justin's friend Ben, but a man named Jared Logan. On the morning of the incident, he said he called Barb's mom to check on her, but that most mornings, Barb was usually the one to make that call. He said that after he and Barb left their house that morning, they went to a neighbor's house, who was out of town, to check on it. Then, as he was driving Barb to work afterwards, he said they decided to take a detour to Highway M to see if they could find the blue Ford pickup that needed its windshield replaced. His attorney asked about the inconsistencies in his testimony versus what he told the police prior, that he had been looking for Justin Heim's house, that he was heading to Holman, and two other times when he said that he was heading someplace else.
So let me ask you, is Long Coulee the same as Shufflebine Hill?
No, it's not.
Is Holman the same as Long Coulee?
Yes.
Is Holman the same as Shufflebine Hill?
No.
And do you know where Justin Heim lives?
No, I do not.
Why'd you say Justin Heim, Long Coulee, Holman?
When I watched those tapes and I watched that video, that's not me. It's me in the picture, but it's not me talking. It's not right state of mind talking in that. I wasn't thinking of where I was going or what I was doing. I was thinking of Barb.
He said that really, he was heading to the end of Shufflebine Hill to try and find the blue pickup truck. Todd said that Barb usually carried her Bubba mug around with her, and that she would always hold it in her lap and sip it when he would drive her. On that morning, as they were driving down Highway M, he described seeing something unusual.
And what was it that you saw?
I don't remember what it was. I thought it was a bird. I thought it was a pipe.
Well, when you were you were present in the courtroom when all the interviews of you were played, is that correct?
Yes.
And do you recall when you were first asked what happened, you said a pipe came through the windshield?
Yes.
And was that true? Did a pipe come through the windshield?
Yes, it is.
Did you hear yourself also say at various points you thought you saw a bird?
Yes.
Okay, and I want to ask you about this. Did you in fact think at some point that you thought you saw a bird?
Yes, I did.
How is it that, well, does a bird roll off of a moving truck?
No.
How is it that you thought you saw a bird, but it became a pipe rolling off a moving truck?
Because I didn't think a pipe could fly.
And after it came through the windshield, did you know what it was?
I did not immediately.
When did you perceive what it was?
I don't know.
He then described what happened next.
When you saw what you thought was a bird, what did you do?
I lunged forward.
You say you lunged forward. Can you show the jury what you did that day?
I can try to. I can't guarantee it.
When you lunged forward, were you even thinking about it?
No.
So, as best you can, what did you show the jury what you did? And by the way, were you belted into your seat?
No.
Was Barb belted into her seat?
I don't remember.
What was Barb's usual practice?
She always wore her seatbelt. I never wear mine. We always talked about it because my son doesn't wear his because of me. And she always said I should start wearing mine so he would wear his.
But you never did?
No.
Todd said he had his hands on the wheel, and with his left hand, he lunged.
Do you know what your right hand was doing?
I do not know.
Do you recall in the interviews that were played that at one point you said you lunged with both hands?
I do recall that.
Do you recall that at one point you said your right hand was on the steering wheel?
I do recall that.
Do you recall which it was?
I do not recall.
After you lunge, tell the jury what happened.
After I lunged, the pipe come through the windshield. Everything happened so fast. Barb started flailing and moving around. And I was to the coulee road, so I quick turned onto the coulee road. And I thought I put the car into park, but I apparently put it into reverse. And that's how I ended up in the ditch the way I did.
Do you know how long that took?
I do not.
Do you recall looking at Barb during that time that you were still driving?
Yes.
What do you recall seeing?
All I can recall is I had to reach out to push her back up. She kept trying to come over towards me.
And do you recall with which hand you reached out?
My right hand.
Do you recall anything else?
No.
He then told the jury what happened next.
What if anything, do you remember next?
I remember getting out of the car. I walked around the back of the car. I opened her door, and she was leaning forward, and the door wouldn't stay open.
So the door wouldn't stay open. Were you between the door and Barb?
Yes.
And what was the door doing?
It wanted to keep coming shut on me.
And what was your intent in being at the car door?
I wanted to get Barb out. She wasn't moving at the time.
He said the pipe was still hanging in the windshield and the door wouldn't stay open. He said he got the pipe out of the way and tried to lift Barb out of the car. He said all he knows is that something was caught on her in the car, and so he had to reach around her with both arms and tug at her.
I tried to take her out. I think I tried to take her out nicely, but I couldn't get her out. Something caught, so I gave a tug. And when I did, we fell backwards, and she landed on me, and I rolled her off of me. And I started doing CPR on her.
And when you fell backwards, where were you located?
Well, I was, my feet were right at the foot of the front of the door, right in the bank. So I fell straight backwards from there.
So would your heads have been near the right rear wheel?
Yes.
He said he then started giving her chest compressions. And at some point, he called 911.
At some point, you called 911, is that correct?
Yes.
Why didn't you call them immediately?
I don't know.
Do you remember what you were thinking?
No.
Do you remember even having a thought process at that time?
No.
His attorney brought up Randall Erler's testimony, the man who said he drove past and didn't see anyone in the car. Todd said he never saw him drive by, but until the first responders arrived, he remained with Barb in the ditch. He said that when he went to the hospital, he never left and stayed with Barb until the end.
Did there come a time when you learned that her brain would not recover from the insult?
Yes.
Were you asked to make a decision about whether to unhook her from machines that were keeping her alive?
No.
Was that just done?
Yes.
Did there come a time when, prior to that being done, you were given time to be with her?
Yes.
And in that time, what did you do?
I just talked to her and held her hand and gave her a kiss.
When you talked to her, what did you say?
I told her that I loved her too. And I'd always take care of her mom.
You said, I love you too?
Yes.
Why did you say, I love you too?
Because Barb and I knew each other so well that we didn't say, I love you and I love you, because we always said it together, so it was always a love you too. And whenever we'd text or something, that was always what it was.
Did you go home that evening?
No, I did not.
Why didn't you go?
I didn't want to go home without Barb there.
Todd said he didn't go home the next day either, that he stayed at his mom's house for the next few days. On the Thursday after her death, he got a phone call to go into the police station for an interview. He said he hadn't taken his anti-anxiety meds until he got there. Why do you continue to wear your wedding ring? His attorney asked. Because I'm married to Barb, Todd replied. He told the jury that he loved his wife and still does, and that he has never once lost his temper with her. On cross-examination, District Attorney Grunke wasted no time asking Todd about his inconsistencies and what he first told the officers he spoke to and what he's saying today.
Mr. Kenhammer, the morning of September 16th, while you were still at the accident scene, you spoke with Officer Wicklund first, correct?
No.
You spoke with Officer Leffelholz, the first sheriff's deputy was Officer Wicklund.
Correct.
And you told him that you were driving to Holman, correct?
Yes.
And you also talked to Sergeant Ailey that day and you told him that you were driving to Holman, correct?
Correct.
And you gave him the name of Justin Heim and it was a guy you worked with at Crown, correct?
Correct.
You also told your son, Jordan, that the reason you were driving that way was you were driving to Holman, correct?
I don't remember that.
You told Investigator Leinfelder in the interview that we watched that you were driving to Holman, and again you mentioned Justin Heim, correct?
I mentioned Johnston Heim.
You weren't driving all the way to Holman, though, were you?
No.
You said the keys were in the truck at the end of the driveway, correct?
I did.
You said you did work for him all the time, correct?
I did.
And you said you had just called him a month before, correct?
I don't recall if I said that or not.
Those were all lies, weren't they?
No.
They weren't true, were they?
No.
Justin never needed a windshield from you, did he?
Justin said he needed a windshield in the lunchroom at Crown one day, yes.
Did Justin Heim personally need a windshield from you?
Justin Heim was going to purchase a windshield from me, yes.
When you were informed that Justin Heim was talked to and didn't back up your story, you then said it was his friend who needed the windshield, right?
I don't recall if I said that or not.
You don't remember watching the video here with the police?
I watched several videos, yes.
Do you remember telling them that it was his friend who lived somewhere else, it wasn't Justin Heim himself?
I may have said that, yes.
You did say that, didn't you?
I don't recall for sure if that's how I worded or not.
Well, the police then found Ben Paff, correct?
Yes.
Ben Paff did not need a windshield from you, right?
No.
And now today you have a third story, right?
No, I have the second story.
You told police first that you were going to Holman to Justin Heim's house, correct?
Yes.
Justin Heim didn't need a windshield and wasn't even home that day. You then said you were driving to his friend's house, right?
No.
You never said that?
No. Not that I recall.
Okay. Well, it wasn't Justin Heim or Ben Paff. Now it's somebody named Jerry Logan?
Yes. It was that all along.
Well, it's not what you said, though, is it?
No, it's not.
Grunke continued to question Todd's story.
You said that you were driving to look for a truck, but you really had no idea where the truck actually was.
I had an idea where it was, yes.
Did you ever talk to Jerry Logan about his truck?
No.
Do you know where Jerry Logan lives?
Not exactly, no.
So you were driving around looking for a person that you hadn't talked to and don't know where he lives, right?
Correct.
On a day that Barbara has to go to work.
Correct.
You said to the police you drove around Thursday night, too, looking for it, right?
I said that.
You said you went to Holman and up to Mindoro, right?
I said that, yes.
That wasn't true, was it?
No.
You never drove anywhere Thursday night, right?
I drove home from work.
After that, you never drove anywhere, right?
I don't recall.
You don't recall if you drove anywhere Thursday night?
No, I do not.
Do you remember telling the police you did?
Yes.
Well, did you?
I don't recall if I drove anywhere Thursday night after I got home from work. I went to the Michael and Jessica's house after work, and then I recall I went home, but I don't recall if I went anywhere after that.
Where would you have driven?
We go for rides all the time.
Did you?
I don't recall if I did or not.
Well, that was another lie, wasn't it?
It was not a lie.
You were telling the police a story that they would go chasing, and you can explain why you were driving north, correct?
At that time, I could not explain, no.
For 3.5 hours, they told you that story didn't make any sense, and you still kept saying the same thing, right?
Yes.
3.5 hours, you never brought up, you know, maybe I don't remember, maybe it was a guy named Logan. You stuck to that story, right?
There was another, yes.
You even told them, I'm 100% of my story, right?
Yes.
Grunke then brought up the discrepancy with what time Barb typically started work, and what time Todd had told police she started.
You told the police from the very start that Barb worked at 8:30, right?
I did tell him that, yes.
You lied about that too, right?
I didn't lie.
She didn't work at 8:30, right?
There were mornings she started at 8:30.
She was supposed to work that day at 8,
yes.
Right? You said a typical day off for you, you would drive her to work, right?
Correct.
You'd get up with her, get her water together, right?
Yes.
Then you'd call her to work. You drive her to work, right?
Yes.
And in September, that entire school year so far, every day was 8 o'clock, right?
Yes.
There was no 8:30 time in there, right?
No.
And she couldn't just not show up at 8:30, right? She'd have to call.
If she's going to be significantly late, yeah.
Can you identify which day that fall she worked at 8:30?
No, I can't recall.
Well, there aren't any, are there?
There was days that she started late.
Would you like to see her time records again?
I don't need to, no.
Well, just make sure. Let's...
Grunke handed Todd Barb's work records.
76 is her work records, not September. Can you show me a day in there where she worked at 8:30?
Well, I can't show you a day that she worked at 8:30, no.
Good, thank you.
But I can also, okay, we'll just leave it like that, yeah, thank you.
You know that her work called at 8:02, you heard that testimony, right?
Yes.
They knew she had to be work at 8, right?
Yes.
Is it possible Barb just didn't know for the first time that year she had to work at 8:30 instead of 8?
No.
She knew she had to be there at 8, right?
Yeah.
And at about 5 minutes to 8, the two of you were driving north on County M, right?
Correct.
And she didn't call in to work, did she?
Not known.
She would have been late, and she knew it.
Yes.
She wasn't able to call because she wasn't physically able to call, correct?
She would have been able to call, yes.
Well, you'd already heard her at that time, hadn't you?
Nope. I did not hear Barb.
Her purse was all located in the back seat on the seat, correct?
Correct.
She couldn't have called if she wanted to. She couldn't even reach her phone.
She could have reached her phone.
In the back seat?
Sure.
Do you have a reason why she wouldn't call in when she knows she's got to work at 8 and there's no way she's going to make it by 8?
I don't have a reason.
That would be out of character for her, wouldn't it?
Yes.
She was a punctual worker.
Yes.
Worked on time all the time.
Yes.
If she was late, she'd call in.
Yes.
On the day that she died, she didn't do the one thing that she always did.
Yes.
You don't find that odd?
I find a lot of things odd, yes.
You have no explanation for that, though?
I do not have an explanation for that, no.
Grunke changed the subject to Barb's mom and how Barb called her around 7:45 every morning on her way to work. But on the morning she died, Todd called her, driving home the point that two things Barb would normally do that morning, she didn't do. Then the topic went to the Kendhammers' finances and bills they had to pay, and a text message conversation about that between Todd and Barb from the night before she died.
You said that Barb was the one responsible for bills?
Yes.
Did you have some unpaid bills in your vehicle?
No. I had one, I'm sorry. It wasn't in my vehicle, I don't think, though.
What was that one?
Allied Electric.
And how much did you owe Allied Electric?
I think it was
$4,000. Did you also have a conversation on Thursday by text message with Barbara about another unpaid bill?
From Best Kept?
Yes.
Yep.
And Barb sent you a photo of a note, and the text message said, "Nice!" exclamation points, right?
Yes.
And the bill was from January 16th?
Yes.
And this was September 15th?
Yes.
And the bill hadn't been paid?
It had been paid. It was a cash pay. They forgot to mark it paid.
Grunke asked Todd about his employment history, pointing out that he had been fired from A1 Glass, left Glass Service Center because he didn't like working for four bosses at once, and left the business he started because of business differences he had with his partner. "Do things have to be your way?" Grunke asked. "No," Todd replied. Grunke then asked Todd about the scratches he had on his neck.
When the police noted scratches on your neck, you first said that that was from working with Glass, correct?
I said that, yes.
You don't work with Glass at Crown, do you?
No.
And you work with windshields, but that's not the same as working with broken glass, right? I assume when you install windshields, you're not getting scratched up from broken glass.
It depends how bad it's broken.
Well, were these scratches from glass?
No, not from glass doing at home.
You said it was from working with glass.
Correct, I said that.
That was a lie.
It wasn't a lie.
It was not true.
It was not true.
Scratches were from her trying to get you off of her, weren't they?
Nope.
The two of you were fighting and she was scratching your neck?
Nope.
She was scratching your neck, her nail broke. Looks like a fight, doesn't it?
No.
Not at all?
Well, it might look like it, but it wasn't.
You said that you had to, in the police interview, you had to drag her out of the car. Do you remember that?
I do remember that.
You also said that she rolled out at first, but you put her back in. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
You said that the door kept closing. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
If you're standing between the passenger door and the car when it's open, you'd be facing Barbara on the seat. The door would be behind you, right?
Beside me, yes.
Wouldn't it just be easy to just keep the door on your back, hold it open, and attend to Barb?
A lot of things would have been easy.
Well, that would have been easy, right?
I can't say that.
Well, you could keep the door open pretty easily with your behind, right? Right?
You could, yes.
And you said she first rolled out, but you had to put her back in to get the pipe out of the way, right?
Yes.
How was the pipe in the way?
I don't remember how it was in the way. It was hanging in the way.
In the way of what? What was in the way of?
The pipe was hanging through the windshield.
Yeah.
Down past the, by the seat.
Yeah. What was in the way of?
Getting Barb out of the car.
Okay. The pipe wasn't lodged in the windshield solid, was it? It was loose?
Yes.
You could just take that pipe and just slide it back out from the inside and attend to Barb, right?
In a perfect world, yes.
Well, in any world, right? In this world.
Objection argumentative. Sustained.
Why wouldn't it be easy in this world to slide the pipe out and attend to her?
I wasn't thinking that.
Well,
I don't know. I mean, the door wouldn't stay open, and I was trying to contend with her, and
she was unconscious?
At that point, yes.
It wouldn't have been easy to just pick her up and move her out, would it?
It wasn't, no.
Why wasn't it easy?
Because something was caught on her.
What was caught on her?
I don't know what it was.
Well, there wasn't anything down by her feet, was there?
Something down there was caught on her, yes.
The only thing in the photos is her shoe.
Okay.
Well, what else, what would have been caught on her then?
Something was caught on her.
For speculation. Ask and answer. Overruled.
You don't know?
I don't know.
Grunke asked why one of Barb's shoes was inside of the car and the other was outside. He asked if that happened during a struggle, and Todd said no. He then focused on the pipe.
Now, you said to the police that a pipe came off the truck. Do you remember that?
I did say that, yes.
You said it a number of times, didn't you?
I did, yes.
You actually said that you saw it as it came off the truck, right?
I did one time, yes.
You said it rolled off the truck, right?
I thought so, yes.
Now, today you said you didn't know what it was until after it hit the car, right?
Yes.
You thought it might be a bird at first?
Yeah.
Did you think a bird would come through the windshield?
No.
You wouldn't have to hit your fist at the windshield for a bird, would you?
No.
If you didn't know what it was until after it was in the car, why would you need to hit the windshield?
Because I did say at one point that it was a pipe.
Well, you said at one point, but did you see a pipe coming at you through the air?
I did. Yes, I did see a pipe coming.
At what point?
I couldn't tell you. I don't remember.
It went pretty fast, right?
Yes.
And if at first you didn't even recognize it, you had even less time to react, right?
Yes.
And you motioned on direct examination of how you punched the windshield, and you motioned with your left arm across your body up towards the windshield, right?
That's how I thought it was, yes.
But you had marks on all eight knuckles of your fist, right?
Yes.
And injury to your thumb, right?
Yes.
You think reaching over your body, you wouldn't just hit the back of your hand?
I don't know.
Well, it's because it didn't happen, right?
Yes, it did happen.
You punched the windshield with enough force that quick because you thought you saw a pipe coming at the windshield?
Yes.
And you didn't react in front of you or reach out for Barb, you punched the windshield?
Yes.
With both hands?
With one hand, for sure.
Well, how the injuries get on the other hand, then?
I don't know. I don't remember.
From punching Barb?
No.
Not from punching the windshield?
It's not from punching Barb.
It's not from punching the windshield, either.
I don't know what it's from.
You're the only one there, Mr. Kenhammer.
Well, I said in one interview I thought I hit it with both hands.
Okay. You let go of the wheel?
If I hit it with both hands, I had to have, yes.
You said you didn't hit the brakes.
I don't remember hitting the brakes, no.
You didn't lose control of the car?
I don't remember losing control of the car, no.
And after that, you must have hit the brakes to make the turn on a Bergen Coulee, right?
Yes.
You drove for a little ways on Highway M before Bergen Coulee, right?
Yes.
You didn't lock up the brakes, did you?
I don't recall.
Did you see any skid marks on the road? Do you remember locking up the brakes?
I do not remember.
While we're on that topic, your memory seems to fade at certain parts, Mr. Canning, and be solid in other parts.
Okay.
Is it possible you're making this entire story up?
No.
Not possible?
No.
When you made the right-hand turn, you then put your foot back on the gas?
I don't recall.
Well, you'd have had to go another 300 feet, right?
Well, it's a downhill slope, I think.
You were coasting?
I don't recall.
You would have had to put your foot on the gas to go another 300 feet, right?
I don't recall.
You must have put the foot on the brake to make it stop, right?
I don't recall that either.
Well, logic would say you'd have to, right?
It doesn't have to. I don't recall if I did or not.
How did you get it into reverse without hitting foot on the brake?
I don't know if I put my foot on the brake. I don't remember.
Grunke then asked if Todd had gone into the trunk since some grass had been found in there.
Now, there's some grass in the trunk. You saw that?
Yes.
The grass would have been tall there, right?
Yes.
Pretty good sign that the trunk was open, right?
Yes.
You don't remember?
No.
There was some dirt inside the trunk, and it looked like something like the pipe had been dragged out over the back of the trunk. Remember that?
I do, yes.
Pipe was in the trunk.
Okay.
You went in the trunk to get the pipe.
I did not go in the trunk to get the pipe.
You went in the trunk for some other reason?
I didn't say I went in the trunk. I don't recall if I went in the trunk.
There'd be no reason other than getting a pipe out. Is there?
I can't tell you that.
Because you got the pipe out.
I did not get the pipe out of the trunk.
Grunke asked if Todd had attempted to call Justin Heim about a week after the incident, alleging that he made the call from his son Jordan's phone, which he had been using at the time, after he found out that police had spoken with Justin. But Todd said he never made that call. The defense then called a string of family members and friends of the couple to the stand, including their son and daughter, both of whom described their parents as having a great marriage. Their daughter called it, quote, absolutely perfect, and said she modeled her marriage after theirs. Barb's best friend also testified that Barb never complained about Todd to her and that she never saw any injuries on her when they would get together. And Barb's brother testified that Todd and Barb's relationship was, quote, very, very good, and said that Todd had been wonderful to them and that he couldn't say anything better about him. All witnesses who saw Todd at the hospital after his wife's death said that he was distraught and broken down. One even called him a frazzled mess. Prosecutors put on a rebuttal case and presented two witnesses, Jared Logan and Justin Heim. Jared Logan testified that he has known Todd for years, but said he never told anyone in 2016 that he needed his windshield replaced. And Justin Heim took the stand again and testified that he did in fact receive a call from Jordan Kendhammer's phone about a week after the incident. In their closing arguments, the state argued that Todd had killed Barbara and that it wasn't an accident. And the defense argued that the state hadn't even proven how Todd had killed her, that they never explained how it happened according to them. The jury of 10 women and 2 men deliberated for about 9 hours before finding Todd Kendhammer guilty of first-degree intentional homicide. Todd is due to be sentenced on March 9th, 2018, and he's facing life in prison. According to Barb's obituary, she was the kind of person who loved life. She loved things like crafts, camping, family trips, snowmobiling up north, tending to her flowers and her flower garden, and spending time with her family. Her family wrote that she had a special way with animals. She loved taking care of them and taking them in as pets, and not only cats and dogs, but donkeys and chickens too. They also wrote, quote, Barb always put everyone else before herself. She always made sure everyone was taken care of. True to this nature, she gave the gift of life to many by being an organ and tissue donor. Barbara will live on in the hearts of her family and friends and the donor recipients she never met. And that's all for today's episode. A special thanks to Jane Lee for her incredible research on this case. And thanks to all of you for listening. If you want to listen to the full trial in its entirety, check out Lady Justice 2188 on YouTube. She has an amazing channel, and I'll put the link in the show notes. As you're aware, this was a very complex case with a lot of details, a lot of changing stories, and a lot of audio. So I'm really interested to hear what you think about this case. First of all, do you think Todd is guilty of murdering Barbara? Did it bother you that the prosecution didn't lay out an exact scenario of how it might have happened? What did you think of Todd testifying? Did it change your opinion on the case? And how about the fact that family and friends of Barb and Todd, including their own children and her brother, came to his defense? Let me know by joining my discussion group on Facebook at courtjunkie.com/Facebook, on Twitter at courtjunkiepod, on Instagram at courtjunkie, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. A lot of you have been emailing me your case submissions lately, and I just want to say to keep them coming. I do take them seriously, and I add them to my long list of cases to research. And as a reminder, if you don't like hearing the ads, or you just want early access to these episodes, you can do that by donating as little as $1 a month to this podcast. Just go to courtjunkie.com/support, and that will redirect you to my Patreon page. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.